Rhetoric was, as you know, one of the seven great arts of antiquity. And I once came across a handbook used by the ancient Greeks in rhetoric. It was really a dictionary which set out one by one various challenges which an orator could face. And it had paragraphs explaining each. Only one of the titles had only one word after it, and that word one was flew, and afterward the Greeks wrote flee. I can't flee the pulpit this morning, so I hope you'll indulge with me, and that my voice and your patience will last out the morning. Crime and violence, our favorite subjects. We're fascinated by them. We read, some of us, an endless supply of murder mysteries and suspense stories full of blood and gore. I'm told that in almost every bookshop across the land, Agatha Christie outsells the Bible. The newspapers know of our predilection, and the front page always features a neat little fascinating mass murder, some act of violence, and one of the major stories in the evening television news is always cut, taken of the same kind of episode. Mass murder we find particularly fascinating. We bought millions of copies of Truman Capote's Blood and Gore, In Cold Blood, sorry. And we were fascinated and read reams of type about Mr. Manson and his bloody women. It's hard to know where the basis of that fascination lies, but certainly it's true that a good bit of our reading, of our listening, of our conversation deals with crime and violence. Hardly a social evening passes without someone talking to someone else about the latest electric sensor that they've put up in their homes in order to ensure that they are well-kept prisoners. Now, the thing that's fascinated me about our fascination and willingness with blood and crime and violence is that we're willing to deal with the specific. We're fascinated by the details of a particular case. We make cults out of Hitchcock movies. We can recite to you to our friends the houses on our street that have been vandalized in the last few years. We'll quickly pass a rumor about a rape at the local shopping center. And yet when one tries to get serious about crime and about violence, to go below the level of the reporter, of gossip, of detail, and to deal with cause, with the philosophic issues, with the psychological and emotional issues, then I've generally found that there's a great deal of resistance. I'm always reminded of the good lady whom I tried one evening when she brought up the subject to get to talk with me about crime and violence on a philosophic level. She quickly stopped me. You know, she said, it's just too sad a subject. I really don't want to think too much about it. There's no answer to it. So we dropped it. And 10 minutes later, I overheard her telling a friend what she was going to serve to the block group that was coming over because several houses in her block had been broken into that summer and they were going to establish some kind of block watch. Now, we're willing to talk about crime and violence on another level, the nuts and bolts level, the level of the criminal justice system. Most of us have some ideas, half-formed generally, about what could be done by people out there, the police, the judges, the courts, the correctional authorities, in order to increase our safety and our security. And we're quite willing to talk about those. One line of conversation runs to the effect, let's lock up the bastards and throw the key away. And there are a whole group of people who are convinced that only if we could only round up without too much legal red tape the delinquents and the criminals in our society, pack them willy-nilly into some kind of jail, they and we would be the better for it. And there are those who take a more refined position and who argue that one of the problems is that the criminal feels that, and with some justification, that he will escape punishment, that there are no standardized sentences, that the rate of the solving of crime is very low, that if we could guarantee, really, that crime would be found out and punished, we would markedly reduce the existence of the crime. And then there are the more kind-hearted people who argue that it's really not their fault, but ours, that we've created the kind of economic and social system which does not provide employment or an adequate and meaningful education or easy opportunity, easy access into American prosperity. And until we do so, until we reform the society, we cannot expect any kind of significant reduction in the rate of crime and of violence. Now, all of these ideas are argued by one or another of our friends passionately. The problem is that, by and large, they don't hold up to the known research. If we were to take, without concern for due process or justice, we were to take a dragnet and round up all the delinquents and all of the people who commit street crimes and lock them up and throw away the key, we would not only be doing very little in terms of their ultimate rehabilitation, we would not only be burdening the society with a cost we might not be able to afford, but we would be doing something which would be unnecessary in terms of our own protection, quite apart from the well-being of the people who are in prison. For there's a strange fact about crime and violence, and that is that most crime, most street crime, most violent crime is committed by those in their teenagers and in their 20s. And that someplace between the age of 30 and 35, almost everyone who has been in this criminal world falls out of it and joins the straight society. We don't quite know why. But we do know that only a hardened criminal group remains in that world beyond the early 30s. And that it seems that the era of strain, of violence, of adolescent behavior is over. The needs of adult life become evident to the person. Whatever the reason, we would be locking up for long periods of time men in their late 30s, men and women in their 40s and 50s, who long since had ceased to be dangers to the society or sources of crime, dangers to us. What about the idea that if only we could solve every crime and guarantee a particular sentence to every criminal, for every criminal act? Obviously, the deterrence is a factor in the control of crime. It is not yet proven directly how much. And beyond this, putting a person into a so-called correctional institution does not, in fact, guarantee in any way that we improve them, make them better able to adjust to the society. Now, the answer to that on the part of those who take this line is that the problem is with the correctional institutions, that America has never invested the money, the human service skills, psychological and psychiatric professional skills in the rehabilitation of the criminal, which we ought to have invested. That our jails are more detention cells than they are, in fact, rehabilitationary institutions. And there's a great deal of truth to that. But in a country like Sweden, where a great deal of time and money and attention has been given to rehabilitation, a rather sad fact has emerged. And that is that in that population which creates most of the crime, those between 12 and 30, if they are imprisoned, the rate of recidivism, the rate of those who return to prison from American institutions is 8 in 10. In Sweden, with all of the human service skills, with all of the correctional skills which are involved, they've been able to reduce that rate to only 7 out of 10 returning to crime, being caught and sent back to prison. And what about those much nicer groups of people who argue that the problem is really our problem? The society is unjust. There's poverty, there's unemployment, there's lack of opportunity, there's inadequate education, particularly in the center cities. And crime is a direct result of the failures of the society. Here again, the research, unfortunately, does not bear out a very legitimate philosophic and political position. During the Depression, the crime rate went down, not up. The crime rate in America shot up in the 50s, in the 60s, precisely during that era when the employment rate was lowest, the opportunities in this larger society the largest, and prosperity more broadly shared than ever before. And if you follow the crime rates in the last year or two, you'll have noticed that they have tended to fall during the recent recession or depression, call it what you will. Poverty is not the immediate cause of crime. What is? How shall we begin to think about crime? Most of us, I suspect, when we think about crime, echo consciously or not, the thinking of a 16th century English philosopher named Thomas Hobbes. Hobbes argued that by nature, the human being is governed by three great passions. By a passion for wealth, which may lead to theft. By a passion for glory, which leads to the desire for power. A willingness to elbow one's way through life without concern for what the hurt one is causing others. And finally, by the fear of death, which often leads a person to be willing to kill to protect that which he has and himself. And governed as we are, according to Hobbes, by these three basic thrusts of human nature, mankind would fall into a jungle situation where everyone would be against his neighbor were it not for the state, which he calls the Leviathan. If the state did not impose its authority on us, restrict our actions, we would elbow one another for the goods of life, take what the other has if we were stronger than they, defend what we have at whatever cost against the greed of the other. But because the state has power, the state sets rules which we cannot violate except at great cost. And we learn ultimately to limit the degree to which we will indulge in any of these passions. And ultimately, we learn to use these energies more constructively. Hobbes didn't know the word to sublimate, but that's the phenomenon which he was suggesting. That we take the aggressive drives and that we learn because of force majeure, because of outside force, because of we're frustrated in any direct engagement of this aggression, to use it more constructively. So Hobbes has taught us to look to the state, to look to the police power of the social order in order to effect law and order. And most of us, I think, unconsciously or unconsciously agree with him. We expect the justice system somehow to create security for us, somehow to staunch crime, to punish the criminal if he performs a criminal act, and to protect our security. And to a certain degree, this is effective. And obviously, certain things could be done to tinker with our present judicial system, legal system, in order to improve its effectiveness. But I'd like to suggest that in societies where the legal system operates more efficiently than it does here, let's say in England, where you'll not be called down to testify against a car thief or a purse snatcher time after time after time, only to have his lawyer gain one postponement after another to try and free him from the charge because he will tire you out before the case will ultimately come to court. In a system like England's, where the system operates with far less sensitivity to these kinds of patience with these kinds of delaying activities, where a case is moved along with due speed, where sentences tend to be more lengthy than they are here, and parole not as easy to come by. Even in a system like England's, the crime rates have risen remarkably since the Second World War, and the state itself seems not to be able to control the crime problem. I'd like to suggest that Hobbes was partially right, but that he caused the world and Kant to look at the state as a solution to the problem of crime, when in fact we have to look at ourselves, at all of our social institutions, if we want to deal with the problem of crime. Let me illustrate what I mean from our own American history. During the American Revolution, there were a number of people who agreed with the idea of the revolutionaries, that is, they agreed that America would be better off if it was freed from British tyranny, but who were afraid of the revolution because they said that if people were accustomed to defy legitimate authority, they would soon come to contemn all authority. And then, in a sense, they were arguing that if one began to destroy the authority of the state, the authority Hobbes had posited, ultimately the state would be powerless to staunch violence and crime. But there was no great rise in the crime rate during or after the American Revolution. Crime began to rise at a significant rate in the United States between the years 1820 and 1840. That is, during the first period of rapid urbanization. And Americans have ever after been convinced that there's a direct relationship between urban living, the crowding of the city, and crime. And during those early years, those first years of the cities, what was happening? Young men were coming alone from abroad or coming from the farms to the city, adrift. There were no institutions developed to take care of them. They began to live wherever they could. They began to mix with others who were as ruthless as they. Alcoholism was rampant. The average American in 1830 drank nearly 10 gallons of liquor a year. And they fell into you having all the animal energies of the young and none of the restrictions with which they had been accustomed. They fell into what was called at the time bad ways. And you had a significant rise in crime. But an interesting thing happened around 1840. And that is that from 1840, really to the Second World War, despite the increased pace of urbanization, crime rates in the United States did not rise. During a period of massive immigration, during a period of massive population dislocation, during the period when, for the first time, there was an urban proletariat, during a period when the divisions between the poor and the robber barons were increasingly apparent, despite all of that, insofar as the researchers can work out the statistics. And the statistics were not carefully kept in those years. There was no significant rise in the rate of crime for nearly a century. And the question is, why? Why during this long period with so much dislocation, with a civil war? Why during this period when it was very evident that there were those who had and those who haven't? Why during this long period did crime not rise at some predictable rate? And why did crimes only rise at a significant precipitous rate during a time of great prosperity, when more and more of the society were moving out of poverty into some kind of middle-class living, and when, by every standard, America was enjoying the greatest wealth, the greatest sharing of the wealth this society or any society had ever known? Now, those who have thought about this subject would argue that what happened during the 19th century was the fact that there was a particular morality, a particular cultural ethos abroad in the land, broadly shared by almost all segments of the society. It had to do with discipline, self-discipline. It had to do with industry. If you worked hard, you would get ahead. It had to do with thrift and delayed pleasures. It had to do with a Protestant work ethic. As you sow, so shall you reap. It had to do with even with one's dress. One went to work buttoned up. One went to work in uniform. It had to do with a sense that there were social responsibilities which were broadly shared. It had to do with the fact that one's responsibility to the public order lay not only in avoiding crime, but in avoiding being a public nuisance. Call these Victorian ethics. Call these bourgeois values. Call them what you will. But the 19th century saw a fascinating development in terms of education, in terms of child rearing, in terms of family management, which was somehow pervasive at all levels of the society. During the 19th century, mothers and fathers were taught to raise their children following the monition that I read to you from the book of Proverbs. Train up your child in the way that he shall go, and he will follow you the rest of his life. He will follow you the rest of his life. What parent expects that kind of patterning today? During the 19th century, education was not looked on simply as the three R's, but as character formation, civics, the teachings of self-discipline. There was a way to write your letters. There was a way to spell every word. There was a way a child was to be dressed and cleansed before he went or she came to school. Education dealt with character formation. And those who have analyzed the popular magazines which talk to parents about how to rear their children found those magazines filled with advice on how to teach honesty, how to teach clean speech, wash out their mouths, how to teach responsibility, how to make them stand up and take their lesson, how to punish them for their crimes before the society would have to do so. And interestingly, when we look at the social order, we find that at all levels of the society, there were adult Sunday schools, YMCA-type programs, adult education activities, groups of people who meant for cultural or spiritual or physical uplift. Somehow, everything in the society conspired to speak of responsibility, of character, of self-discipline. And so, despite all of the pressures, the economic and social pressures of the 19th and 20th century, early 20th century, oh yes, there was crime. There was a tenderloin in every community. Oh yes, there was violence. There was the drunkenness of the Saturday night in the miners' towns. But when one added it all up, the violence was, and the crime was not much worse than that in most societies at most times. In fact, it was far less. This was the era where Americans got accustomed not to having to lock the doors of their homes. This was a period when Americans became accustomed, as no people had before, of being able to walk openly and easily in the parks and in the streets of their cities, men and women. What happened in the 20th century? Well, the many things happened. The spread of drugs, the spread of guns, racial tension, elements which were to a certain degree unique to American life. But if we look carefully at the larger scene, we find in every industrialized society in the 20th century, there was a major increase in the level of violent activity and crime, particularly after the Second World War. In Europe, the crime rate began to rise much earlier. Why? One answer, which non-Marxist historians are increasingly giving, has to do with the change of attitude, the change of educational philosophy, the change of personal philosophy, which all of us have undergone. We began to look upon the values, the uplift values of the 19th century with scorn. We said they were hypocritical, there was a double standard, they were bourgeois, they were restrictive. And we began to develop this philosophy, which is so pervasive today, of self-expression, of self-realization. Everyone was to do that which was right in his own or her own eyes, as long as it did not intrude upon the rights of someone else. Where the 19th century had spoken of duties, the word duty now became an old-fashioned word. We began to speak of rights, not of responsibilities, but of opportunities. No one was going to tell us what we were to do. We didn't expect to train up our children in the way that we had gone. A youth culture emerged, untrammeled, free. And this openness, this new freedom, this sense that somehow the old institutions and the old disciplines were restrictive, a misinterpretation of Freud, which looked on all restrictions and somehow inhibiting and therefore unwarranted. This whole approach to life, which is typical of the 20th century, which we share, all of us, as members of this time and of this place, this ethos no longer creates that kind of discipline, that kind of superego, those kinds of institutions which say, now, wait a minute, don't do that. You shouldn't. Why not? I'm a free man, aren't I? Why can't I do it? I won't be restricted by all of the limitations, the narrowness of my predecessors. I want to be free. I want to do my own thing. And somehow, as this philosophy of self-expression has permeated the society, at all levels of the society, people have found it more and more difficult to form character, to form a hard inner core of do's and of don'ts. Precisely at that moment when the society is freest and most open, we have plunged ahead with many of us having as yet unformed consciences, unformed senses of what is right and what is wrong, what we may do, what we may not do, what we will not do. Most of us are very confused about standards, about what is right and what is wrong. And we see this especially now when it comes to crime, because we identify crime with the street, with stealing a car or a purse or breaking into a house, things we would never do. But we see this especially when it comes to all those relationships which were once so clearly defined, which are no longer clear at all to us. Is adultery a crime? Is homosexuality a crime? Is it a crime for us to be manipulative of others? Is it a crime for us to be careless of the rights of others as we seek our own success? Is it a crime for us to train up our children in a code which may no longer be modern? Is it a crime for us to fail to give to our children do's and don'ts, opportunities to form a conscience against a clear family code? Our society has not yet worked out its commandments. It is like the children of Israel when it left Egypt. When the tribe left Egypt, after they crossed the Red Sea and the Egyptians were no longer pursuing, they were free from. We are free from the constrictions of the past. We are free from the hold of the institutions of the past. Schools no longer tell us what we must learn. Parents no longer tell us what we must do. Society no longer tells us what values, what ideology we must adopt. We are free from. What the 20th century lacks is Sinai, a set of appropriate commandments to its own age, a set of do's and of don'ts that are broadly accepted and broadly shared and somehow institutionalized into the community. We are free from, but we are not yet free for. And because we do not yet share a common vision, how is it possible for the young, who are going through the age of confusion in any case, to know what is expected of them? To know what are the limits, the permissible limits of freedom as we would now define them? We don't give signals. We don't provide a roadmap, because the one series of issues that the 20th century has refused to face up to are the ultimate questions. What is right, absolutely, and what is wrong, without question? We explain away, we justify, we rationalize, we find exceptions. We do everything but really discuss commitments to family, to community, to values. And that's the challenge. Crime will continue to fester among us, to be a cancer in the society, as long as and until this society moves as the children of Israel moved. From the moment that the exhilaration of being free of the restrictions of the past to a willingness to say these are the values by which we will live our lives in the present. Values. Clear. Understandable. Values. be honest to you, let's be honest with ourselves. If we look at the novels which we read, they don't offer us any suggestion as to values. They deal with the bizarre and the kinky and the and those who are exploiting the far edges of this freedom. And if we look at our school systems, we find them wrestling with the basic problems of literacy, confused as to what values really are. Civics is no longer taught. Issues of character have to be worked out, but they depend largely upon the preconceptions of those who are in the classroom. Homes. How many of our homes are clear as to the standards which they will maintain? How many parents are seeking their own freedoms rather than worrying about the values by which their children are to grow up? The reason that we don't like to talk about crime on a basic level, to deal with it philosophically, psychologically, is that we have to deal with ourselves. Ultimately, the rise of crime in the 20th century is due to the rise of permissiveness, self-indulgence among the society at large, among us. Many of us have individually fought our own good fight, but we've been overwhelmed. The forces of religion, the forces of education, the forces of social reform have been overwhelmed by the pell-mell search of a society for materialist rewards and hedonistic pleasures. Now, we can't go back to the values of the 19th century. They're not appropriate any longer. We have to forge our own ethic. But forge it we must. For unless we do, our homes will become more and more places of defense, doors behind which we cower against the world out there. When I came back to Cleveland 28 years ago, no one thought really about going any place in the city. When I went to visit somebody in an apartment building, I went directly up to their floor and knocked on their door. There wasn't a single home with a little blue hexagon in front of it saying that this home has some kind of very complicated electronic equipment which will guarantee that if I cross the threshold unbidden, the police from seven districts are going to be down on top of me. Many homes that I would enter, there wasn't even a lock that was closed on the door. How things have changed. Parts of the city, many of you here feel that you couldn't go into, you wouldn't even drive through. Your homes are carefully protected, innumerable doors, locks on your doors. When I go to make a call in an apartment, I'm ushered into a little glass cubicle, televised, and I look on a board for the name of the person that I want to call on, and there's a coded number then, and unless I remember the coded number when I dial the telephone, and half the time when I reach the whoever it is upstairs, I'll say, oh goodness me, which of these many buttons should I push? We've narrowed our own world. We've reduced our own freedoms in this pell-mell search for some kind of larger freedom. I would venture to say that most of us are physically at least less free today than we were 30 years ago. And yet it is this pell-mell search for freedom, freedom from, which has allowed crimes to spawn in so many areas of the society. What's for it? The solution to the problem of crime is a solution, involves a solution to the problems of our society. After 30 or 40 years of self-indulgence, we have to take ourselves in hand. We have no real guidelines. We know we need community structures. We know that the institutions of religion and education and of culture must be put to the common good, must be used carefully. But how? How we'll only discover in the doing. And that's the test. And that's the challenge. Amen.